We're going to be studying 1 Samuel chapter 21. We're continuing on with David's story. What happens in life as he's currently in the process of fleeing Saul. We're going to open with a prayer if you don't mind. Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we ask your blessing upon this prophet study. Keep our hearts and eyes and ears open to you, God. You've been wise and kind to each of us throughout our lives. And God, we ask you will continue to open our hearts to you. Continue to teach us your ways, that we may learn from the past, learn from our predecessors, that we may obey you in our own lives. We continue to strive with you, God, and ask your blessing. In the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. We are in 1 Samuel chapter 21. This is a relatively short chapter, but as most things, it's deceptively simple. We ever read it? Yes, we do.
1 Samuel chapter 21. David went to Nob to Abimelech the priest. Abimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" David answered Abimelech the priest, "The king charged me with a certain matter and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about your mission and your instructions. As for my men, I have told them to meet me at a certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find.' But the priest answered David, 'I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women.' David replied, 'Indeed, women have been kept from us as usual whenever I set out. The men's things are holy even on missions that are not holy. How much more so today?' So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd. David asked Abimelech, 'Don't you have a spear or a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's business was urgent.' The priest replied, 'The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, is here. It is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There is no sword here but that one.' David said, 'There is none like it. Give it to me.' That day David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, 'Isn't this David, the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sing about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands.' David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So he feigned insanity in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Achish said to his servants, 'Look at that man. He is insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you must have this bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house?'"
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate that. That was 1 Samuel chapter 21. Relatively short chapter, as I mentioned before. Are there any questions or comments regarding this chapter before I begin my little spiel? Yes, David.
I've always understood that David himself went in and took the bread, but it shows... reads differently.
He was given the bread.
He was given the bread. Much different picture.
Yes. David could not have taken the bread. That would be highly
right.
Against the will of God. Contrary to Torah. He's not allowed to steal. But you're right. He was given the bread. Any other comments or questions? As Jeff runs to his wife, Tammy.
I'd always wondered how the Philistines knew who he was. Because back then they didn't have the mass media with CNN plastering your picture everywhere.
No wanted posters,
you know. But when it says here that the only sword that they had available was Goliath's, imagine him coming in with Goliath's sword.
Dead giveaway.
That pretty much was a dead giveaway that there's only one person who would have that sword.
Considering Gath is Goliath's hometown.
Yeah.
He was born and raised in Gath. It's not a big town. It's relatively small. So everybody's going to know who David is. Everyone knows to recognize a sword. Everyone knows exactly who killed their hero from their own town. So yeah, it's makes you question what was David thinking. any other comments or questions? Yes, David.
I hadn't seen this before, but it was kind of funny. The king there was saying, "Have I need of a mammon that you have brought this fellow to play the man in my presence?" Before they says, like, you know, like, "Don't I have enough of these already?"
Exactly. I have enough crazy people around me. Oh, wow. There's a Jewish tradition. I won't say it's right or wrong, just a tradition. That the Aish, one of his children was a mad person, had gone insane. Just a tradition. And so they said, do I not have enough? I already have a mad person in my family. Do I need more? It's just tradition, though. Neither right or wrong. It just is. Yes, Hank.
What does it say about David that he was comfortable with Goliath's sword?
Very large, strong person. That says a lot about David. One, he's the story first person he ever killed at all. He used that sword to do it. So it means something to him. But also, as we've discussed before, Goliath's sword would be roughly about 5 to 6 feet long on the blade. I mean, I don't know about you, but that's my height. How tall does David have to be able to wield that sword as his own? Significantly taller than me, most likely, and relatively strong. As it pointed out that, we were discussing, when David went to battle Goliath, Saul put his armor on him. Well, it already says that Saul was a head taller than anybody else, which means makes Saul around 7 feet, give or take. So David, in order to wear Saul's armor to start with, has to be pretty darn big to begin with. He's a fairly large individual. Also very skilled at killing at this point in time. It says a lot about him. A lot about his willingness to take that sword and use it as his own, which he used it for quite some time. Any other comments or questions? This is a relatively, as I mentioned before, it's a short chapter, but it's deceptively simple. There's a lot more in here than meets the eye. And so I'm going to extend to the next chapter as well, which is going to explain a lot more as far as who these priests and what their role was. Yes, Sharon.
Even though it was given to him, isn't it just for the priests?
Correct. We'll read that today.
Okay.
It's for the priest and his priest's family, and they have to be in a holy state to eat it. So for the priest to give it to somebody, we'll discuss what that means and why he would do so. Yes, Hank.
I'm sure you're going to go into this, but why was Ahimelech afraid?
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to go into that. And since that starts off early, I'm just going to jump in my little thing, because that's one of the first things I cover. Okay. My little spiel. This is was a difficult chapter for me when I was going through it, because I read it, and okay, well, why is this important? Why would God put this chapter in here? Because it didn't say a whole lot at first. And I was studying this thing 2 weeks ago. Okay, well, just wrote down a few notes. Well, this doesn't mean anything. Something else has to be hidden here that I'm not seeing as to why this chapter's here. And fortunately, this morning, I had a few more minutes to take a look at stuff. It's like, that was it. It has a lot to do with who Ahimelech was. First of all, to back up a little bit, a couple chapters ago, just a rundown history, David, Jonathan, they had conspired together to find out whether Saul really wanted David dead or whether it was just the spirit that was inside of Saul trying to kill him. So they got a little scenario going together. David sat, hid in the field for up to 3 days, but actually it was by the second day. So for 2 days, he was in the field. No food and water. He might have had water, but no food. He's just hiding there because he couldn't be seen. If he was seen, he'd be killed. So he's hiding in the rock with no food at least, most likely a little bit of water, not much to eat at all. He's relatively hungry at this point then as a result. So Jonathan comes out and says, "All right, yes, you're right. Saul wants you dead. Run." Now here's the deal. Is that a king's order that David run? It was king's son, wasn't it? Because Jonathan told him to run. For a friend's order. So when David comes to this priest, and the priest says, "You know, why are you alone?" He says, "Oh, the king ordered me on a mission." Is David lying to him? Seemingly it is. The only time a son of a king can give an order and it be a king's order is if the king is not in their presence. Was Saul at that field when Jonathan ordered David to flee? No. So it can, stretching it pretty hard, but it can be not a lie. And the fact that it is a king's order, because he was to tell nobody, to flee with only what he had, and that's exactly what he did. He didn't go home and grab anything. He just fled. He followed Jonathan's instructions to the letter. Flee with what you've got. Don't look back. Just run. It's pushing it. In my mind, he stretched the truth a little bit for Ahimelech. But then again, we'll get the chance to find out why he was able to do that and God not be too terribly upset with him. So Hank's question. David comes to Nob. By the way, my little map up here, if you don't look at it, you have Nob way up here. It's about 12 miles north of Jerusalem, roughly. I have Jerusalem, this little black. It's really not in the story, but I just for reference know where it's at. Gibeah is where the king is at. It's where Saul and his family. Ramah is where Samuel lives. So David, he was in Gibeah with Jonathan. And Jonathan said, run. David ran to Nob. Why did he choose Nob? Anybody recall? Well, the story actually tells you. Where did David first head to after he killed Goliath? To Nob, the priesthood. Well, why? Leave the sword there. But what's big on David? What's big with him? God is. So he went to Nob because the priesthood is at Nob. Now, we already know what happened to Shiloh and Eli and his sons. God killed them all, destroyed it, took the ark off. The whole story. We know the Ark of the Covenant is not at Nob. The Ark of the Covenant is in a man's house down here south of Bethlehem. It's Kirjath Yearim, I believe, is the name of the city. That's where the Ark of the Covenant is at, and it will be there for a total of 20 years before David pulls it out. But where is everything else? If the Ark of the Covenant's down here, because that's what was left, and Shiloh was wiped out, which is just next to Nob, Shiloh was, where do you think all the stuff in the temple went? To Nob, the nearest town there was. Where did all the priesthood go? Because they weren't down here with the Ark of the Covenant when it was in the Philistine territory. Where'd they go? To Nob. The city was wiped out by the Philistines according to God's command from Eli because he did some evil things with his sons. They all went to Nob. But the Ark of the Covenant was in the Philistines' hands for 7 months and of course we transferred back to Israel and we know the story of that, at least recall most of it. And it ends up in Kirjath Yearim, I forgot the guy's name of his house, but anyway. In the one man's house. David eventually pulls it out later. So, all the priesthood in Nob, who all is there? Is the high priest in Nob? You know, you'd think so, wouldn't you? I would. Why not? All the other priests are there. But see, if that's the case, then Ahimelech is the high priest. Now, those of you who haven't read the next chapter, Ahimelech is slaughtered at the command of Saul. And all his father's household is killed. So, I mean, Saul would have ordered the death of the high priest. Not going to happen. Saul's not that foolish. Yes, he ordered the death of this man and all the priesthood, but he didn't kill the high priest. I'm confused. Why not? My little family line down here, bear with me. Ahitub was the high priest shortly right following Eli. He was, as Eli died, Ahitub was the next guy around, so he was the high priest. He had at least two sons. The older son, Zadok, which if you go through 1 Chronicles chapter, I think it's 6 or 7, whatever chapter it is, it lists the list of all the high priestly lines. Zadok and Ahimaaz and Kenaz all that way, that's the high priestly line. Ahimelech is not mentioned because he's the younger son. Ahimelech is the younger son. Where is Zadok? Who Zadok, by the way, is not killed next chapter, by the way. He's not. Ahimelech and all of his family lines killed. Zadok's not. Where is Zadok? Where the high priest is supposed to be. Where the Ark of the Covenant is. The high priest never leaves the Ark of the Covenant. That's his one function. You protect this thing with your life. Is he going to leave it down here while he's up in Nob? No, not going to happen. Zadok is down here, and the guys up in Nob are everybody else. where all the stuff is. Now, that's also the high the priest's job, not the high priest, the chief priest's job, to protect all the stuff. You have the ephod, you have the breastplate, you have the utensils, you have the altars, you have everything else which is not in Kirjath Yearim. It's up here in Nob. When they do all the sacrifices, guess where they do it up? Up here in Nob. They do any sacrifices down in Kirjath Yearim? No. Because there's no temple. They can't. They have to wait. So just to give you a heads up on who these guys are, because it means a big player in what is happening between David and Saul. Ahimelech is afraid. Why is he afraid? He comes out, sees David coming all by himself, unarmed, no escort. Ahimelech sees him and says, uh-oh, something's wrong. Not fearful for David, but fearful for himself. Why would that be the case? What was that? Well, Ahimelech doesn't know this yet. Ahimelech is obeying Saul as far as he knows. There's no word that Saul wants David dead other than the town of Gibeah knows it. And all of Saul's men know it. But nobody else in most of the country knows it yet. Some probably do. Word travels pretty quickly. Although, unlike today, we have email, internet, they have to do it word of mouth. But still, certain things take a little more time to travel. So has this information traveled that Ahimelech... Does Ahimelech know that Saul wants David dead? Not likely. As a matter of fact, the next chapter he actually argues, Saul, I had no idea what's going on. Saul doesn't believe him, but he's himself. So why is Ahimelech afraid when he sees David all by himself? What would you feel or think if you, as the second in line to the priesthood, high priesthood, is in charge of all the priestly stuff, everything there is, and the one top major killer of the king is coming to you all alone. You fear for your life. Yeah, you're scared. And this man is a trained killer. He's very, very good at what he does. As far as Ahimelech knows, I did something to offend the king. And he doesn't. David's coming without witnesses. No one will see what he does to me. I'd be scared too. Ahimelech's not a trained killer. Yeah, he's killed animals, but that doesn't count. There's a world of difference between a human being and an animal. Yeah, he is scared. It could mean something to him. He doesn't know what it means. He's a little hesitant. What did we do? Because unfortunately, everyone knows Saul's temperament. And Saul's whim at killing people is already known throughout Israel. So Ahimelech has reason to fear not actually David himself, but the potential order that he might think David has from Saul to kill him. That's a legitimate fear. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay, we'll move on. I'm going to go a little bit faster because there's something really important we have to get to. David, of course, gives him the spiel, the king ordered remission. He told him, no man shall know anything about the matter, which I've sent you. Which is true. Jonathan said, don't tell anybody. Just run. Don't tell your wife. Don't tell your family. Just go. Which that part is true. Whether the king did it, that's the stretching the truth a little bit there. Thus I informed my attendants to be in a certain secret place. That's a blatant lie. He has no attendants. And now, what do you have available? Five loaves of bread, whatever there is in the land. So, what does Ahimelech have? Well, he has 12 loaves of bread. Let's read what the law says around these 12 loaves, because they mean something. They're there for a reason. This is in Leviticus. You have the right chapter here. Chapter. Wrong page. 15? No. 20. I had it marked wrong. That's the problem. Okay, I don't look my notes over here. Oh, chapter 24. There are 24 verses. There it is. I didn't have it marked wrong. I just been blind. Okay, chapter 24, Leviticus, verse 5. And you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of the ephod shall be in each cake. You shall set them in two rows of six in a row, on the pure table before the Lord. You shall put pure frankincense on each row, that it may be on the bread for a memorial, an offering made by fire to the Lord. Every Sabbath, He shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel as an everlasting covenant. It shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him, from the offerings of the Lord made by fire, a perpetual statute. That's the law, and these are the bread that we're referring to that Ahimelech has available to him. Now, as he explains to David, it's removed every week, and fresh bread is put on it. So this bread is 1 week old. How many of you have eaten a week-old bread that's been sitting on the table out in the open? You can do it. It's a bit tough. If it's sourdough, you might be able to do it. It's a bit tough. It's soaking a little bit, but it didn't hurt. Does David have anything to soak it with? Maybe water? Well, who knows? It's not the most pleasant thing to eat, is my point. It's been around a while. It's not like fresh bread out of the oven. It's been there for a week. It probably still tastes like bread. I don't think mold grew on it just yet, but you're probably pushing your luck. Unless it is sourdough, maybe there isn't any mold. Hard to say. But not the most pleasant bread to eat. But it's what is available. Now, it says right here quite plainly, verse 9, it should be for Aaron and his sons, and must heat it in a holy place. So why is it that Ahimelech is offering this to David on the condition that David and anybody who else eats it is clean? Is David a priest? Yes, Jeff.
Nazarite.
Well, that might work. You just decreed you now a Nazarite vow for at least the next few hours. Can he do that? Can Ahimelech give that bread away to a non-priest person? Apparently so. Why is that? It's being replaced, but the old bread still it must be eaten in a holy place or a holy state. Aaron and his sons. David's not a biological son by any stretch of the imagination to Aaron. Just there's no physical relation whatsoever. So Ahimelech, if he gives it to his sons, him and his sons, they must all be holy, right? Does Ahimelech have any, well, let's say, hypothetically speaking here, the priesthood priest himself has three sons. Three. Two of them are in the priesthood line, meaning that they're likely to be along the same priesthood family. The third son has opted to not go through the Levitical priesthood, which is to go another route. Is the third son allowed to eat any of that bread? Yeah, he is. Well, why? He's still part of the family. Is that son's son allowed to eat it? The grandson? Of course. Still part of the family. No matter how corrupt that son, the path he may choose, is, as long as he's holy at the moment in time he eats it, it's okay for him to eat it. So with Ahimelech, we already know there's no relation between David and Ahimelech at all. But there is one unique thing about David. Unlike Ahimelech's older brother down here, I'm going to put the Kiryat Yearim, by the way, because I like to point to it. Since I can't spell it, I'm just going to make KJ. So bear with me. Kiryat Yearim is Zadok and all the high priests are down there. Ahimelech and all the other stuff is up here. All the sacrifices, everything happens up here. Does he go down and give the bread to his brother Zadok? Does Zadok eat any of the bread? Well, if he's really quick, he can run up there really fast. It's only, what, about 20 miles? You know, quick, you know, hop, skip, and a jump, right? No, it doesn't travel that quickly. Ahimelech, if it's his bread, can give it to his grandchild, can't he? Those three sons, what if the third son was a woman? What if he had two sons and a daughter? Can she eat it? Can any of her children eat it? Can any of her grandchildren, no matter who she marries, eat it? Yeah, because who does she normally marry? She would eat another priest or a king. Either are acceptable. You marry either one of them. Not that she married a king, so you can't. So if she gets the bread, though the parental lineage is diminished, actually, because she has brothers, as far as her line is concerned, she's dead. There's no longer a Levitical line through her anymore. It's just whoever she marries. He can give it to whomever he wishes once it's his. And it's under his possession. The drawback is, they have to be holy. She may be corrupt normally, but the moment she touches it, the moment she eats it, she has to be holy. As long as David's holy, Ahimelech is stretching it to include him as well. Family. There's a reason he becomes, why he's stretching it to family. It has to do with Ahimelech's son. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I mean, in a sense, Samuel already made him holy.
He was set
apart already and anointed. So
very much so.
You know, that the priesthood couldn't be ignorant of that.
No doubt. And pronounce the guy's name. Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, the only one that doesn't get killed by Saul, attaches himself to David as a brother. Essentially, at this point, Ahimelech is saying, all right, David, here's the bread, my son. A man who he was afraid of. Here's the bread, my son. For all practical purposes, that's what he did. Ahimelech does the same thing, my brother. He treats David as his own brother. Under the same protection to fight for one another, with alongside one another. Next chapter. Again, this is going to mean something in a minute. So he gives the showbread, okay, no, by the way, holiness to somebody means no sex, no touching things that are impure, clean clothing. Those are the rules, basic rules for holiness. Holy place also means holy state. Meaning a person has to be in a holy state. Like, not like your body must be holy before you're allowed to touch it. A state of being. Not just a location. Because you could be in an unclean location, but if you are clean, in spite of what the foot away from you happens to be, there's a dead pig right there. Well, I'm not touching it. I'm still clean. The pig's there. I'm still clean. So a holy state or holy state of being is actually the point when the holy place. So as long as David was holy, that was okay. We're not discussing the fact he lied to the priest, because that may argue something he's not holy. But yeah. That's debatable. Priest would have known that? Yeah, possibly. Wouldn't have. Oh, that's true. The priest would not have known that. What was David doing by lying to him, though? What did it give Ahimelech when David told him a lie? Comfort? Satisfaction a little bit. Not David's goal wasn't to lie. His object wasn't in the lie. The object was in to assist Ahimelech in something. What did it assist Ahimelech in? Giving the bread, that was the immediate gift. His conscience, exactly. For one, you're not going to kill me. That's good. That's a good thing. But Ahimelech knows, okay, you mean no harm. I believe you. Here, have. And that's going to serve Ahimelech in the next chapter when Saul says, you helped my enemy. Ahimelech says, wait a minute. I didn't know anything about this. The feud you have between him, what are you talking about? He wanted bread. He said he was on a mission. He was clean. Here. It gave Ahimelech the reason he needed to tell Saul he was innocent. Had David told Ahimelech the truth, I am fleeing from Saul. What was that? Plausible deniability, as you call it, yes. Had he told Ahimelech the truth, would that have been a good thing? It depends. Well, it depends, because had Ahimelech known the truth, he could have easily still given him bread, but also given time for Ahimelech to flee. Either would have probably worked. David made a judgment call. I'm going to protect you by giving you a story that will shield you from the wrath of Saul as best I can. Doeg, the Edomite, which pointed out that he's reading there, he's listening, he's overhearing, he's seeing this. He sees Doeg, okay, yeah, you know what I'm doing. I'm giving Ahimelech protection. You have no witness against this man, Doeg. You cannot say that this man helped me knowingly. It protected him. That was David's goal, to protect him. Did it work? Unfortunately, no, it didn't. because he ends up dying anyway, because Doeg just says, hey, you know, he helped so-and-so, I'll kill him for you, that kind of thing. I'm doing good timing. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I mean, in a sense, you could sort of say that, you know, Ahimelech was going to die anyway later on in life.
Oh, that's true.
It's the matter in which he died, which heaped another load of something upon Saul's head.
Yes, it did. But it's interesting, not that you say know this, but David takes full responsibility for the death of Ahimelech and his family. David is the one that says, it is my fault that he's dead. Not the person who killed him. I am responsible for him. I went to him for help. I tried to protect him, and it didn't work. I am guilty of it. And David took responsibility for that, which is right. He is fully responsible. Had David gone to anybody else and asked for bread, he probably wouldn't have gotten bread. But he went to one place he trusted, the priesthood of God. Why? Because they're not corrupted by Saul. The priesthood does not obey the king in that fashion. The priesthood obeys God. It is the only connection he has to the one and true creator or one who guides him. So it's a good thing to keep in touch with the priesthood. They're independent of the one who wants him dead. Yes, Bill, you had your hand up there for a second.
I hadn't really thought about this before, so I'm going out on a limb here.
Go ahead.
Could this be setting up the house of Judah as a priesthood?
This is beautiful. Yes, thank you very much. We're going to be discussing that shortly. because it has a lot to do with what's going on with this priesthood line versus this priesthood line. They mean something as to why they're split into two and why David went to one and not the other. But we're not there yet, so you have to wait. Yeah, you don't mind waiting. So it says in verse 8, now there one of Saul's servants who lingered before the Lord. He hung around Nob. Why was he lingering? Well, let's see. He was Doeg. I pronounced Doeg. That's probably an incorrect name. Could be dog. I don't know. The Edomite. He was chief of Saul's shepherds. What would a chief of Saul's shepherds be up here in Nob for? The sheep are up there. when the king needs to do a sacrifice, does he come down here to Kirjath Jearim? No. He goes up to Nob, where everybody else is. Why have the sheep living everywhere else in the world? Why just put them right where they belong? Where are you going to use them the most? Nob. So yeah, he's going to live there. He hangs out there. That's his job. So he's there for a reason, taking care of all the sheep that get slaughtered for various reasons, you know, sacrifices or for holidays or whatever that's going on. That's his job. It's his task. But once David saw him, verse 9, David immediately says, perhaps you have under your hand a spear or a sword. I did not take my sword or weapons with me. Once he sees Doeg, he says, I need a spear or a sword now. He knows who this guy is. David knows full well what this guy is capable of, and he's an Edomite. Does he fear the priesthood? Does he fear God? No. Does he fear David? He only fears his master Saul, and probably a sword. Hence, spear or sword. He's an Edomite. He doesn't care about any of these people. Which shows up next chapter as to why he was there and how he was used by Saul. Because he was Edomite, he was perfectly willing to slaughter all the priests. I'll do that. Volunteered, actually. All the Israelites, did any of them volunteer? They looked at Saul and said, excuse me? I'm not going to touch these guys. These guys talk to God and you don't. They didn't tell him that directly, but that was the attitude they gave him. They feared the priesthood. They feared God. But Doeg the Edomite, I'll do it. And goes up and slaughters them all. Quite happily. Of course, David writes about that. He's a songwriter. What do you expect? He writes about Doeg the Edomite, how evil, rotten scoundrel he was. But that's for next chapter, because that's when he does all his bad deeds. By the way, David writes about this chapter too, which we'll get there in a minute. So, of course, Goliath's sword, he brought it with him. This is the key. It's wrapped up in a cloth behind the ephod. What is the ephod? That's part of it. What else is in the ephod? The The stones are on the breastplate, but the ephod also has two individual stones by itself. They're onyx stones. What was that? Those are inside the breastplate that's attached to the ephod. The ephod's like a tunic. It's like it's a robe. What was that?
Radio?
Oh, radio. Yeah, no. you lost me there for a second. Sorry. Okay. The ephod is a robe that has two stones on it. They're both onyx stones. They're set in gold. What's written on these two stones? 12 tribes. 6 in each stone is written on it. Now, it has cords and various things attached to him. The breastplate that contains 12 individual stones, all different types, on the breastplate, that's attached to the ephod as well. All right? What's inside the breastplate? As I mentioned before, the Urim and the Thummim. And I ask you a question. What does the Urim and Thummim do? No one knows. What is traditionally assumed that they do? What does the Urim and Thummim mean? Gave him answers. Gave him answers from God. Yes or no? Right. Give me yeses or noes. What does Urim mean? What was that?
Light.
Lights, plural. Many lights. What's Thummim? Thummim mean? How do I pronounce it? What's the other one mean? Say it a little louder.
Righteousness.
Light of righteousness. Now, don't confuse with tzedakah, which means righteous. No. Is written in the book of Job. It's an old word, very, very old word. And it's for to be righteous, to be right. It's not tzedak, thank you. That's a different word. It means very similarly. So, light of righteousness. Why is it lights plural? And righteousness is plural. Why are they plural? Say it again. That's more in the menorah. That's kind of questionable. I'll think about that for a while. I don't think about that for a while. Jewish tradition, not that you're going to memorize this, but just for example. What is written on each of these two objects? Not names, letters. Which letters are written on it? Not the tribes. They can spell. He's allowed to spell things. And there's more than 12 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. What's written on it? Tradition. It's tradition only. Let's go through them. Where's your little book? Oh, you don't have it. He's got it. Where's your little book? Actually, it takes too long to find. How about Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Bob, Zai. The entire Hebrew alphabet is written on these things. The alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet. It allows, thank you. This is important as to why this alphabet is written on these. It's going to play in Psalms 34 as to what David was writing about this instance. The entire alphabet is written on it. Now, I don't know if they look like these letters or the blah. Whatever letters they look like, I don't really know. But the alphabet was written on it. It allowed God to spell things. Did God spell things very often? There's only instances which he actually wrote or actually verbalized 2 or 3 words. That's it. Ancient text. There's only a few places it actually talks about. Most of the places are yes or no. Because that's most questions. God, should I do this? Yes? No. It doesn't take a whole lot to say yes or no. That's pretty much it. But when it says, God, who did this? That takes a little while. You got to spell that person's name. When they ask, when they go up to Gibeah against Benjamin, when Benjamin's men slaughter the Levite's wife and scatter her body or concubine all over the they kill her, but he cuts her up and scatters her out all of Egypt. And all the tribes come against Geba, the town which this happened. All Benjamites were out there to defend themselves. They asked, who goes up first? Did God say yes?
It says they did not cast lots. Did God say yes to that question? I asked God, who goes up first? Did he say yes? No, he said Judah. Now you can debate whether he used the letter Yod or whether he spelt the whole name. I'm not going to discuss that. But Judah was the one selected to go first. By God's decree. Because they were asking the high priest. The high priest asked God. So all that stuff, that ephod with the breastplate and all the Urim and Thummim and everything else that goes with it, is all being cared for by Ahimelech and his sons and their family along that route. The Ark of the Covenant, which is down here in Kirjath Yearim, is being taken care of by Zadok and Ahimaaz and all of his sons, the high priest. They're not allowed to leave it, leave his presence. David went to these guys for a reason. Because unlike Zadok, who had the throne of God with him, these men had the word of God with them. They have the ephod. Can you ask the throne of God a question? No. How is he going to answer you? It can't. It's just an ark. It's a throne. It's a seat. It doesn't answer questions. Can you ask the priesthood a question and have them ask God and they get answers? Well, of course. They do it all the time. Yes. That's the thing.
Okay.
Ahimelech is allowed to ask questions. Because as the son of the high priest, because Zadok can die tomorrow, he is allowed to wear that outfit too. I know it sounds funny, doesn't it? But he can. Because a high priest, you are allowed to have more than one serve as a high priest. David actually establishes that later on. But at this point in time, both are serving. One serving up here, one serving down there. When David comes as king, what does he do? He continues on that service. This guy's son, Abiathar and Jonathan, they continue on taking care of the ephod. And this guy's son, Ahimaaz and Zadok, they continue on. He continues that practice of you still take care of that ark until they're united together again. Because otherwise, if Ahimelech is not allowed to wear it, then all the sacrifices, this high priest who's down here has to quickly run up to Nob, do the sacrifices, then run back down again. And then guess what? The afternoon sacrifice comes up. Quickly run to Nob, do the afternoon one, come back down again. And guess what? Then the evening sacrifice goes. How many times is this high priest running back and forth if he does it all by himself? 3-4 times a day. That's roughly, I believe, that's 20 to 24 miles. Into the mountains. Wintertime, pouring rain, snow makes a difference. Is he going to do that 3-4 times a day? Nobody's going to do that 3-4 times a day. That's ridiculous. Because he can't leave the ark. Why can't he leave the ark, by the way? Because when the king calls for it to go to battle, that high priest had better grab it and bring it with him. If he's up here in Nob and the king calls for battle, you know what? I'll get to you tomorrow. Give me a few days. Are you allowed to say that? No, that's death penalty. You don't get to do those things. There are reasons as to why the priesthood was divided into two groups. And Ahimelech is perfectly capable, willing, and legally allowed to wear that ephod in order to do all the sacrifices required. Bless you. Okay. So, the throne of God is down here with Zadok in Saul's control. But the word of God, which is the Urim and the Thummim, the ephod, is with Ahimelech and Abiathar. So why would David travel to the word of God rather than the throne of God? He wanted to hear from God. Next chapter, which we didn't read yet, Saul kills all this particular line. He doesn't kill Zadok and his family. They don't hear from God, and they're not there. No relation, nothing about it. And when Saul needs the Ark of the Covenant, he better have a high priest to bring it to him. Because he's not allowed to touch it. Saul kills all of these guys. But what's the one thing that happens, which we haven't read yet? Abiathar is the one guy who survives. And he takes the ephod, which is this outfit, with the Urim and Thummim, with the words of God, with him, and flees to David. And says, okay, Saul slaughtered everybody. David said, that's okay, you're now with me. It is my responsibility, the same person wants both of us dead. We are now one and the same. As a result, David has the wonderful gift of being able to ask God, hey God, is this right or this right? Oh, got it, thanks, and goes and does it. Oh, should I do this or this? Oh, thank you, okay, and then goes and does it. It happens again and again and again and again. How does he get to do that? Because he has Abathar with the ephod and the breastplate and the Urim and Thummim. He can ask questions and get answers. That is a slick move. It means the word of God was with David. That's prophetic. The word of God is with David. The throne of God is not with Zadok. Fascinating, isn't it? Okay, that was my aha moment this morning. Now, I pointed this out to you. Do you think David realized this? Yeah. You know, in fact, he wrote about it. Psalms chapter 34. He thought this was cool. How I know he thought it was cool, because he did something really unique in this particular psalm. Now, we can go ahead and read it. Let's go ahead and read it. I know this, by the way, this psalm is about the moment in time which David goes to Achish, the king of Gath, and of course they all recognize him and say, oh, hey, you know, this is David, this is David. And he fakes madness, and it works. Now, before I read this, have you ever questioned that? I mean, all right, if I'm the king, and my mortal enemy comes up to me and fakes madness, or at least is mad, am I going to say, oh, well, because you're mad, I'm not going to kill you? Why would I? Yeah, of course not. I'll say, okay, yes, you're mad, that's okay, where's my sword? I'll kill you anyway, because of what you've already done in your own past. Well, but killing them is pretty effective too. But the method in which David did, the only reason it worked is because God was with David. Do you believe Saul, had he tried this, that the king of Gath wouldn't have killed him? Of course, of course he would have killed him. In other chapters, he said he wants him dead. He wants David dead too, but he knows Saul's king. If Saul dies, that means a lot. If his right-hand man dies, okay, second best. Because the king of the line of Israel still could ease on if David dies. But if Saul dies, it doesn't. So it's in Achish's best interest to kill Saul, and in actually this case, should be David too. But for some bizarre reason, this madness, David's completely vulnerable, by the way, at this point. I mean, everybody around him wants him dead. They're all right there. He can't go, can't run, can't fight his way out of it. It worked. It actually worked. Because God was with him. And chapter 34 discusses the fact that God was with him. Okay. This is pretty cool. Now, granted, in my little spiel book up here, my verse 1 starts with the introduction, versus your verse 1 probably starts with, which mine says verse 2, that I shall bless the Lord at all times. Which is more correct anyway. I shall bless the Lord at all times. Always shall his praise be in my mouth. By the way, I'm reading this version, so yours will be very slightly. Don't worry about it. In the Lord does my soul glory. May humble ones here be glad. Declare the greatness of the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought out the Lord, and he answered me. From all my terrors he delivered me. All who looked to him became radiant, and their faces will not be shamed. From all his troubles he saved him. The angel of the Lord encamps around his reverent ones, and he releases them. Contemplate and see the Lord is good. Praiseworthy is the man who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, you, his holy ones, for there is no deprivation for his reverent ones. Young lions may want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord will not lack any good. Go, O sons, hear me. Fear the Lord, I will teach you. Who is the man who desires life, who loves days of seeing good? Guard your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking deceit. Turn from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are toward righteousness, and his ears to their cry. The face of the Lord is against evildoers, to cut off their memory from the earth. They, the righteous, cried out, and the Lord heeds. From all their troubles he rescues them. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted, and those crushed in spirit he saves. Many are the mishaps of the righteous, but from all the Lord, all of them the Lord rescues him. He guards all of his bones, even one of them was not broken. The death blow of the wicked is evil, and the haters of the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and all those who take refuge in him will not be condemned. Was there anything unusual in that psalm I just read? Something that would catch your attention? Those of you who read English, no. Yes? His bones? None of his bones would be broken. Yes. Right. If you don't serve him, those who do not serve him will not be redeemed, so to speak. And that those who are doing evil will not be redeemed because they choose to do so. The thing I want to get to is, you know what I mentioned? What was written on the Urim and the Thummim? That God could spell things? Right? It was the Urim and the Thummim, the two things inside the breastplate. Aleph, the whole alphabet was written there, right? Or that's the tradition. What do you think David did in this psalm? He spelled things. Verse 1. In Hebrew. Sorry, I think it's verse 1. It says, I shall bless, right? But in Hebrew it says, Abarucho. What's the first letter of Abarucho? Aleph. Verse 2. It says, in the Lord. Ba'adonai. Bet. Verse 3. It says, declare, or gadul. Gibel. Oh, interesting. Verse 4. It says, I sought, or dorashit. Dalit. In the middle of verse 4, because valve is an and word. Umikol. And from all. Bob. Verse 6. Pronounce this correctly. Piva 2. Verse 7. Z. Which means this poor man. Or better, Piva 2 means all who looked. This poor man is verse 7. Holne, the angel. Tamur, contemplate. Yeru, fear. Kifirm, young. Nahu, go. Mikol, who. Nitzor, guard. Sur, turn. Anai, eyes. Ayin. Pene, face. So, Zoku. Ah. That, Zoaku. Sorry, there, the righteous. Zadi, the Zadok, the righteous. Korov. Close. Rabos, many. Shomar, he guards. Zomes, the death. Pode, redeem. The point is that David took the letters off of the alphabet and actually wrote a psalm to it regarding this particular event. The reason I wanted to point it out is the word, et. Aleph to Tov. The entire Hebrew alphabet, inclusive of everything. It's the word which you translate for a proper noun for God. Or the predates a proper, it's pronoun that predates the name of God. Like et Yeshua. At Yahuwah. They're doing something. Aleph to Tov is inclusive. So he wrote a psalm that includes all letters from Aleph to Tov. Because the word of God is with David, not with Zadok. That was the point. But as to why I'm missing a letter, I don't know. But he did everything else there. He got all the other letters there. He did them all in order, too, which just caught me off guard. Actually, I'm missing one here somewhere. Man, that's disappointing. I'll find it some point in time, maybe next week. Yeah, that categorizes and breaks them down. But this he actually wrote inside the psalm, which was kind of cool that he actually did that. Not indicative of an insane person at all. Because it'd be pretty sane to be able to write a psalm and the first line of each letter means something. I think our governor got in trouble for that yesterday or the day before that. Any questions? I apologize for taking you a few minutes over. Yes, Sharon.
Conjecture, and this is what maybe the rabbis said, that the Urim and the Thummim,
what they look like,
the heavenly lights, do they also conjecture that there was tones associated with
you
the
know,
light?
I've heard of that, but only by one guy who said so. So I don't go by what one man, one person,
yes.
It's just one.
Well, just that God spoke creation into being. It was. And I just wondered if you know,
that's
that was
an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that.
Okay.
I hadn't thought about that. Because note, all these psalms have lyrics and have a melody to go with them, which no one knows. Yes, Jeff.
Well, my thought on that is that smacks a little bit of a common pagan thread, basically, that if someone can steal God's lucky charm, they get the power of God. I don't think so.
It's a hypothetical thing, which is kind of questionable. Admittedly, I've heard of it. Because there's only one guy who claimed it, and he had no proof to back him up, no evidence, not even scripture. Oh, hey, look, this is kind of support, nothing like that at all. It's like, okay, nice theory, but doesn't mean anything without something else. Yes, David.
The city of Nob would be an excellent place to set up a door manufacturing plant. The simple reason that everybody knows a door needs a knob.
Oh, yes.